and you're tuned to WOWDLP.
Dulang, Dulang, he's so fine.
Dulang, Dulang, Dulang,
wish he were mine.
Dulang, Dulang, Dulang,
that handsome boy over there.
Dulang, Dulang,
one with the wavy hair.
Dulang, Dulang,
I don't know how I'm gonna do it,
Dulang,
but
Dulang,
I'm gonna make a mine.
Dulang, Dulang,
be the envy of all the
Dulang,
girls.
Dulang,
it's just
Dulang,
a matter of time.
Dulang, Dulang,
he's a soft-spoken.
Good morning. This is Sheila Blake, and I'm with Tom Zanakis, and we're the artist experience people. And we're going to do this show on art appropriation and copyright laws. We have an artist experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. And it's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. So look at it, if you can, while you're listening.
Good morning, everyone. Happy New Year to one and all in our listening area, which actually happens to be all over the globe and possibly in some distant planet. Well, you never know, but we want to thank you for being with us this new year. It's our 87th show at WOWD Tacoma Park. We have a very interesting program lined up. We're going to begin the new year with talking about a very delicate and interesting topic about art appropriation and copyright. Thought of maybe we should kind of tackle this delicate topic for an entire show. In our last show in 2019 on Edward Hopper, we talked about how movie makers like Alfred Hitchcock have used Edward Hopper's images in the renditions of his buildings in the films, like the Psycho Bates Motel was actually from an Edward Hopper. And musicians and playwrights and other authors have incorporated images of Edward Hopper as well in their own new forms of art. And this is way after the artist had passed. Well, over the holiday, I saw this farcical but enjoyable movie titled Knives Out. I wonder if some of our listeners have seen it. Well, it's currently playing, and it's a murder mystery akin to like Clue or an Agatha Christie novel. And the movie was just filled with use of visual art and imagery that was on the sets that came from very important images from art history. The movie was basically a takeoff on so many movies and TV shows dealing in murder mystery. A few friends said that the throne of knives in the movie was right out of the set of Game of Thrones. I had no idea because I'm not akin to that series, but the mansion in the film was also Hopper-esque or Hitchcock-esque, if I could use the word. So there's a lot of use of other art in this particular genre. The use of other art forms for reference, inspiration, cross-pollination of the arts, and appropriation has been around for a long time. This has gone on for so many ages, but now with the onset of video and technologies, it takes on a new meaning, and technology is certainly doing it in a lot of different ways.
Well, we started out this show with the Chiffons singing He's So Fine. That was a girl band. And do you recognize that tune? Does it sound a little bit like My Sweet Lord by George Harrison? That was George Harrison's first solo single, and it was released in November 1970, and it topped the charts worldwide. It was the first number one single by an ex-Beatle.
Well, the use of someone else's art in your own work can be very, very subtle. And at times it could mean, it could almost seem like an absolute visual ripoff. And when it gets too obvious, it gets a little sticky. And that's where things get a little into legal matters, which we'll talk about later. But in the music, the classic example is this example of the Chiffon song from 1963, He's So Fine, which was written by Ronnie Mack. Well, the Beatles were very open about their love and praise of American R&B. Well, Bright Tunes Media, who represented Ronnie Mack, who had died before that, filed a copyright infringement on George Harrison, who penned My Sweet Lord. Well, this case dragged on in the courts, you know, for a lot of years, and Bright Tunes pushed hard to get lots of money for the copyright for that song and for further use of the song in airplay time. Well, George Harrison lost the case. He lost also about $1.5 million, and plus some other restitution to Bright Tunes. Well, George Harrison finally admitted, only after the song was famous, that he realized how close it was to He's So Fine. And he remained very, very bitter over it, and he condemned the trial, and the outcome was really about greed and jealousy of his own career. And so, you know, it opened up a lot of issues in music, which continue to play out today.
Well, George Harrison became a devotee of Eastern religions, and he said, in fact, this song saved many a heroin addict's life. So the motive behind writing the song in the first place far exceeded the legal hassle. And they also, after a while, he said that he really got the melody from the Christian hymn, Oh Happy Day, and that was his inspiration. But it is so difficult. Where do tunes come from? Do they just come floating out in the air and you grab them?
Well, one of the things is that, you know, in music, a chord progression could be so similar to another song. There are, you know, many, many songs with the same chord progressions, mm-hmm. and how they're used and possibly the rest. So in this case, in the George Harrison case, it was too close for comfort.
Yes.
You know, it was almost too obvious.
Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to the Artist Experience radio program here at WOWD Tacoma Park. And we're beginning the new year talking about the delicate and interesting topic of art appropriation and copyright of art.
Well, when we got this idea for the show totally, you know, independently, which I think it says something about us working together for these years,
yes.
Sheila.
No kidding,
we came
did.
Up with the same idea for the same show. You came up with this monologue about, you know, how you had art appreciation brought to a heavenly scale. And when you use the word heaven, Sheila, it kind of pricks up my ears. So I wanted you to hear, what's your heavenly idea about art appropriation?
Well, okay, so I have to talk about heaven and God and Jesus. Who among us has seen heaven? Or the baby Jesus, for that matter, or the Virgin Mary. Why do we know her robe was blue? And in fact, it was red in the beginning. But where did these images come from? So the earliest known nativity image is a second or third century painting, and it's in the Catacomb of Priscilla in Rome. And it has the prophet on the left pointing to the star, while Mary sits on the right with a Christ child on her lap. And still, these early images were from the artist's imagination. How did they know? And so over time, the artists developed fully realistic visions with real space and real light and real angels with wings flying around heaven and purgatory with the gods and the goddesses and the adoration of the baby Jesus and the Last Supper and the crucifixion.
Aha, Sheila. So you're really digging deep into very heavenly appropriations of visuals. And well, you know, Sheila, I know a lot about drawing and painting of holy images, and 2,000 plus years this has been going on, coming out of a Christian tradition steeped in the Judeo-Christian text like the Bible and the historical traditions. Well, there's a variety of examples of this, and I can speak for hours on this, but I'm going to keep it simple. The images of the biblical figures, who none of us have seen, over time amounted to nothing but a visual language. It's the way they could depict Bible stories that could be made visually understandable and palatable. Remember, most people back then, they were illiterate. They couldn't read the Bible. So how are you going to make these stories believable? And the oral tradition was the rule, but, you know, putting it in pictures was something that the early Christians especially thought would be a good idea. So by designating a visual nomenclature for the prophets, the saints, the Holy Family, like you say, Joseph, the Virgin Mary, and Jesus, it made these figures in the history of the world identifiable visually and made them more believable and real. It was kind of a selling point, if you will. So generations of artists were using this language to depict the same people in very similar ways. Now, there is sometimes there's a little difference, but not very much. And it happened all the way from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance to today. Mm-hmm. So it's in other words, art appropriation and became a language to help people understand.
Yeah, this is really important, I think, because Western culture really did inherit a visual vocabulary for heaven and hell. One is a place of beauty and serenity, the other of despair, torment, and violence. But where did these artistic representations come from? And to what extent is our Western concept of heaven and hell shaped by art? So Richard Townsend, who's the director of the Museum of Biblical Art in New York, said the answer is almost entirely. And in fact, that's why biblical art up until the modern era was didactic. In the Assumption of the Virgin, which is painted in 1530 in the cupola of the cathedral in Parma, Italy, the artist Correggio, he introduced the idea of this sort of great stadium of heaven, this idea that the saints, God, and the Virgin, and your loved ones are all up there in the clouds. So you can see that the images developed not independently, but through the appropriation of images of one artist to the other, with Giotto, Titian, Tintoretto, Da Vinci, Botticelli. Those are really our touchstones. But it's the appropriation, not the originality of these images, that pass down, striving for more and more believability, more naturalism. And because I wasn't raised in the church, I came to these visions really late, just through my love of art. And I remember my earliest vision of God as this sort of blue, vaporous, giant ice sculpture on a box of ice, because I probably didn't know what a throne was even.
That's really good.
And Andy Warhol, he worshipped at the Byzantine Catholic Metropolitan Church of Pittsburgh. And the theory is that he got his entire format of repeated images from the repetition of icons on the walls of his church.
Well, that's absolutely correct. Well, we should do a show on the mystery of Andy Warhol and his religiosity. He had lots of images of the Last Supper. And he saw himself as, because remember, somebody tried to shoot him and kill him, as, you know, living the Last Supper. And in fact, Andy Warhol was very religious, and I know that from firsthand evidence and that I found about 30 years ago. And he did worship at St. John Chrysostom Church in Pittsburgh. And then he moved to New York, and he went on to do great things. But I think we need to define appropriation. And appropriation has several meanings. And when I looked at the up at the dictionary, Sheila, I was laughing uncontrollably because most of them deal with money. Appropriation deals with money. And that's kind of ironic when it comes for an artist. The word really comes from that. But let's define it. It's a noun. And it's the action of taking something or one for one's own use, typically without the owner's permission. The other definition is the artistic practice or technique of reworking images from well-known paintings, photographs film in one's own work. Well, a lot of people have been doing that for a lot of centuries, and I'll give you just an example from thousands and thousands of years ago. The ancient Greeks never got permission from the ancient Egyptians to make their monumental kouros figures. There were these really large, stiff male figures that you see in archaic sculpture. Well, the ancient Greeks never asked the pharaohs or the pharaohesses, hey, look, guys, you know, we really like those big figures that you have on the outside of your temples on the Nile. We happen to see them on a cruise, you know, that long river that you got, and we really want to use them our own. Is that all right? Well, we know that never happened. The ancient Greeks just basically ripped off the Egyptians. And so they also ripped off their techniques. So, you know, that's what appropriation does. And there are hundreds of examples of this out there in art history of other people using other people's work.
Well, when Marcel Duchamp drew a mustache on the Mona Lisa, he opened up the discussion about appropriation of art. Appropriation in art is the use, as we were saying, of pre-existing objects or images with little or no transformation applied to them. Duchamp introduced the concept of the ready-made, in which he industrially produced utilitarian objects to achieve the status of art merely through the process of selection, like when he put the urinal on the wall and he wrote Armut and signed it, and that became art. So he really explored this notion as early as 1913 when he mounted a stool and on a bicycle wheel, and again when he purchased a snow shovel and humorously described it in advance of the broken arm. The use of appropriation has played a significant role in the literary, visual, and performing arts. In the visual arts, to appropriate means to adopt, borrow, recycle, or sample aspects of the entire form of human-made visual culture. It's really been a lively artistic debate and sometimes lawsuits ever since. It's in music, sampling, who gets credit for melodies, and really any artistic endeavor. So artists are open to all influences, sometimes unconscious, sometimes deliberate. Re-photography uses appropriation as its own focus. Artists pull from the works of others and the worlds they depict to create their own work. Appropriation art became popular in the 1970s. The artist Sherry Levine photographed Walker Evans' photographs from the masterpiece Let Us Now Praise Famous Men without any changes at all. They're just exact photographs of the photographs. And when she was sued for copyright infringement by the Walker Evans estate, they acquired Levine's works to prohibit their sale, and Levine later donated the whole series to the estate. So all of that is now owned by the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Levine's appropriation of Evans images has since become a hallmark of the postmodern movement. And you can see that. I wanted to sort of say that the aftermath of having made those images became part of the art, just as Christo, when he was fighting with local governments to create his earthworks, he used all those arguments as part of the art. So the trials, the local trials, had also a place in the artwork.
It was like a craze.
It was
like a fad in the 70s.
Right.
You know, just use somebody else's stuff and see what, you know, how far it goes.
Exactly. Appropriation art. So all of these artists were greatly influenced by the work of John Baldessari, who just died a few days ago, and Robert Heinecken, both of whom have worked extensively with found or ready-made print photography. Since the 1960s, Baldessari worked mainly with Hollywood film stills, and Heinecken mainly with magazine art advertisements and print pornography. Both artists taught at UCLA and the California Institutes for the Arts in Southern California throughout the 70s, when many of these artists attended school there. Re-photography uses appropriation as its own focus. So a couple of months ago, a largely unknown printmaker named Martin Lewis who is Edward Hopper's mentor, has been discovered. His etchings are so clearly what determined Hopper's vision, for which Hopper never gave him credit. In fact, he totally diminished Lewis's influence in Hopper's work to having given him tips on the etching process.
Wow, that's news for me. That's news to
me. It's true. Just check it out on our Facebook page, and you will see how similar they are. And Norman Rockwell copied his own painting to avoid giving it to his ex-wife.
That's hysterical.
I know. Roy Lichtenstein and Andy Warhol, they both used comics in the beginning of his careers, but when they realized how similar they were, then Warhol started using advertisements and pictures from newspapers, and each of them staked their own territory, whereas Lichtenstein, as we know, used the comics. And concerns are still expressed by critics who say Lichtenstein and Warhol did not credit, pay any royalties to, or seek permission from the original artists.
You're listening to the Artists as Experience radio program here at WOW Tacoma Park, and we begin the new year talking about a delicate topic of art appropriation and, of course, art appreciation, but also the copyright of art, which gets into the second part of the show, which gets a little stickier.
Well, Robert Plant, Led Zeppelin singer, and guitarist Jimmy Page were accused of copyright infringement over their iconic 1971 epic. But in June 2016, the Los Angeles jury ruled that Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven was not guilty of infringing on Taurus, which was an instrumental written by the Spirit guitarist Randy California. Such a great name. And even now, the lawsuit is continuing. There's a quote, good artists borrow, great artists steal, and is traditionally attributed to Pablo Picasso. And who knows who really said it? But
he certainly did it.
He did it.
I mean, he appropriated his whole career was based on African, you know, the colonial, the colonials going to Africa and kind of basically ripping off African masks, African textiles, you know, and bringing them to France and Spain. And his career was taken off with Mademoiselle de Davignon, the great painting where it's nothing but African masks painted.
And there's a contemporary artist, Richard Prince, and that could be his motto too. So Prince mines mass media images to redefine concepts of ownership and authorship. And it's a practice he conceived of while he was working in the tear sheets department at Time Life. So he has a cowboy series, for example, which he started in the 1980s, and he re-photographed Marlboro ads, and he cropped out the text to generate close-ups of mythical cowboy figures. And then he did his nurse works, which he first exhibited in 2003, and they were produced by scanning the covers of pulp paperbacks, transferring them to canvas, and painting over the prints. Richard Prince is an avid collector of American subcultures. He has included biker chicks, borscht belt jokes, and Willem de Kooning canvases. He says, I don't see any difference now between what I collect and what I make. He says it's become the same.
Wow.
So in 2000, Patrick Carriot published a book. He was a photographer called Yes Rasta, which featured photographs taken during his six-year stay in Jamaica. And Richard Prince used some of those photographs to create his Canal Zone series. Prince enlarged the carrier of photographs, and he sometimes cropped them. He also painted over some of the faces and bodies of the subjects of the photographs, but he used some of the carrier photographs almost entirely. Prince did not seek licensing, nor did he ask carrier for permission to use his work. And he's been sued, but only after his paintings began to sell for a lot. His paintings sell for $100,000, and he has never given a penny to the artists from which he's borrowed.
Yes, well, you know, Sheila, this also kind of gets into the ethics of, you know, and business ethics of an artist. And I don't think artists have wrote the book on cleanliness in ethics when it comes to making
right.
money becoming famous. And you know, it was interesting when we went over the script and how we both have had this kind of thing happen to us. I mean, I know of a copyright infringement firsthand that happened to me many years ago when I received a call from a national publishing company to use several of my paintings in a video lecture series on modern art and spirituality. You know, I agreed for them to use them, and it was a one-time usage. And I remember they gave me some little pittance of money and a copy of the video series. Mm-hmm. And then years later, someone called me and they said they saw paintings of mine in a book by a modern author, whose name I will not mention. And coincidentally, he was also the author of that series that was published by the National Publishing Company. Well, the author, without permission, used several of images in the books. And I was appalled, and I actually was really ticked, because I actually know who the guy is. So I consulted a lawyer, I consulted ombudsman and people that kind of deal with this in academia and stuff like that. And they were very uncomfortable because, firstly, it was so obvious of a copyright infringement. But it was a few years after I had known this, because it was done in cryptically. And I contemplated over it a lot. And I'm really a busy guy. And it was a major pain in the bottom to get to deal with this. And, you know, because legal matters are not like my forte. And it's a sad confession, but I dropped it after, you know, starting to do this. Because, I mean, it was just, it took so much time. And I think a lot of people, you know this, that when you start getting into legal matters, it takes a heck of a lot of time out of your life.
Yeah. Well, in my husband Peter's family, in 1961, his uncle Richard, who is a writer and wrote for The New Yorker, he hired the Lester Lannan Orchestra to record tunes from commercials. All these commercials, like 50 of them, Chase and Sanborn, Pepsodent, Chiquita Banana, all the beers, Brill Cream. And he did it as a creative enterprise so the orchestras would play these tunes. And Peter just loved this album. But his uncle didn't get all of the rights to use the tunes. And he was sued. He was ruined. He really was.
Well, so we're going to have to take a break now. It's kind of exhausting thinking about the second part of the show with the legal affairs we're going to be talking about. But we're going to take a break. And while we're taking our musical break, take a look at our website, TacomaRadio.org, and look at the fantastic and diverse programming schedule that we have for our listeners. Let's listen up to an old song by The Who. It's about legal matters, and which gets sticky when it comes to copyright infringers. We'll hear you back in a little bit.
Legal matter from now on. first and you ain't the last. I gain or lose my women fast. I never want to make them cry. I just get bored, don't ask me why. Just want to keep doing all the dirty little things I do. Not work all day in an office just to bring my money back to you. Sorry, baby.
Welcome back. We're discussing the appropriation of visual art, and sometimes music, and how it relates to other art forms. It can get messy when it comes to getting artists and lawyers involved when copyright of someone's art has been used or manipulated in some way.
Well, the Copyright Act of 1976 was enacted to protect intellectual property and basically to hold the rights of the holder of the art or the property of the art to the creation. It's a very long and drawn-out law, and there's been several permutations and combinations since. It engages the concept of fair use and fair use practices for a creator. In 1909, there was a law that was adopted to protect the television, motion picture, and radio industry as it was just blossoming. And since the new forms of communication, we've seen a lot more new ideas coming out of intellectual property, and you hear it a lot on the airways these days. This is a very complicated document. The Copyright Act of 1976 is a copyright protection to original works of authorship fixed in any tangible medium of expression, not known or later developed, for what they can be received, reproduced, or otherwise communicated, either directly or with the aid of a machine or device. That becomes very important today with the technology. The Copyright Act defines works of authorship as any literary, musical, dramatic, choreographic, pictorial, graphic or sculptural, motion pictures and audiovisual works and sound recordings. They're all under this umbrella of the Copyright Act. And lastly, architectural works were added in 1990, which is kind of funny that should have been there in the first place. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this complicated affair gives exclusive rights to the originator of the art. Here are some of the highlights. The right to reproduce and copy the work into copies and phonographs. The right to create derivative works, which we've been talking about this morning. The right to distribute copies and phonographs of the work to the public by sale, lease, or rental. And the right to perform the work publicly in a literary, musical, dramatic, choreographic, pantomime, or motion picture audiovisual work. And lastly, the right to display the work publicly in the same veins and genres. So, in other words, the originator of all this work still has the rights for these things when it's done outside of their hands. The Act was amended in 1995 to include a sixth exclusive right, the right to perform a sound recording by means of a digital studio. So you can have an original song, and if you digitize it, you still have, there is some thing you have to be careful about, that digitizing that same song, and that's happening a lot. And there's been a lot of lawsuits about that recently. Well, the huge Copyright Act had some later additions, and it's really an incredible thing, but the author of it has to really keep on top of how his images are being used out there, which is another full-time job. As you can see, and imagine, the use of modern and innovative technologies in art, video, in the music industry has had a huge impact. And one needs to kind of use copyright to sync with the technology, and we'll talk a little about that later. Well, sometimes copyright infringement lends itself to something what I like to call cross-referencing and cross-pollination of art. In other words, they're using it for the health of the art and not necessarily for the money of the art, which gets into another, and that's happened forever. And I'd like to just talk about some ancient examples of cross-referencing and cross-pollination. Well, Greek art and Buddhist art of India, they cross-pollinated each other after the age of Alexander the Great, when Greek sculptors ended up in India, and they were sharing their art with Buddhist sculptors, And they came up with this great new kind of art form. And you get the same with Buddhist Indian art and Chinese art. They fuse to make another great art form. And the list goes on and on. I mean, the Mughal art of India mixed with the Persian art of the Safavid periods, and they created a fantastic art form, a powerhouse in art of Persian and Indian art. And then, of course, we have the colonial Spanish art, which kind of fused with the indigenous Central and South American peoples, and that created another art form in itself. Yes, there was a lot of pain and agony that went into that, but a new art form was created. So there are a lot of contemporary examples of this, Sheila. Why don't you share some of those?
Yeah, well, there's a contemporary artist, John Curran, and he's known for his satirical figurative paintings, and he imitates the old master techniques and compositions, kind of, he tries to, which deal with provocative sexual and social themes. And he's got a wide range of influences, the Renaissance, popular culture, magazines, contemporary fashion models. He distorts or exaggerates the erotic forms of the female body. And he's stressed that his characters are reflections of himself, rather than inspired by real people. But I don't know what he's talking about, because one of his three graces looks a whole lot like Gwyneth Paltrow. Calvin Tompkins wrote that his technical skills have been put to use on some of the most seductive and rivetingly weird figure paintings of our time, and they are weird.
He's very, very I am very uncomfortable looking at his work.
Me too.
He takes the feminine figure and he really perverts it in such a selfish way. There's something crass about his work, and he technically is a brilliant painter. There is no doubt about that.
I know.
But there's something creepy how he uses the female figure.
Yeah, his paintings are somewhere between the grotesque and the beautiful. I could leave out the beautiful. And they range in inspiration from classical artists like Fragonard and Bouchard to Rockwell and Art Crumb. But really, his paintings are not and never will be mistaken for anything like the sources they're referencing.
Right. He kind of hides that in a sense, in this kind of warped sexuality. And you mention Art Crumb in there, and Art Crumb has been attacked, over and over for his use of how he degrades femininity and women in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of in the same category in some ways, where John Curran, unfortunately, he's appropriated in a way that's uniquely odd in a bad way.
Yeah, that's a perfect word, degrades, because that's the way it feels. And when Mark Rothko was young, and he was very good friends with the artist Adolf Gottlieb, and they were spending a lot of time with Milton Avery at his studio, and Milton Avery was older, and he is a wonderful, established artist. And finally, Sally Avery, Milton Avery's wife, kicked them out. He said they were picking his brain and stealing his ideas. And there's a painting by Milton Avery at the Phillips called Tangerine Moon and Dark Wine, Dark Sea, and it's beautiful.
Oh, it's absolutely magical.
Love that painting.
Yeah, that's a magical painting.
Well,
sure.
One of the best Rothkos I've ever seen is at the National Gallery, and it's really so similar to the Avery. It just leaves out the reflection of the moon, but it's really right there. It's a beautiful painting too. When I was looking up this image, I found that it's also in a reproduction gallery. So there are reproduction galleries online where you can get, in a variety of sizes, the painting that you want for your couch.
Right. Nowadays, it's a big issue in trade. I mean, you have studios in different parts of the world that are reproducing these great paintings, and a lot of people don't even know the difference.
Right.
Visually.
Yeah. Well, in 1962, Gerhard Richter, he said he'd had enough of bloody painting. And at that time, he was really sort of searching to figure out what he was going to do next. And a photo of the French actress, Brigitte Bardot, it just dropped in his lap. And he incorporated it into an abstract canvas that he was working on. And he burned all his own old work. And around the same time, he began collecting the photographs that comprise Atlas, which is his ever-expanding file of source images, from whose panels he still draws, ranging from personal snapshots to celebrity glam shots to advertisements to pornography, landscape postcards to photographs of concentration camps, which he never used because he found them unpaintable. But the results are diverse. He painted both black and white and color portraits of celebrities such as Jackie Kennedy or Queen Elizabeth. He painted anonymous individuals and some family members, close friends and professional associates. And just think about the link between Warhol and Gerhard Richter. It's a very close link there. So Cecily Brown, who's a contemporary neo-expressionist artist, she may have a copycat, or at least that's what she's alleged on Instagram. And imagine Instagram. I'm not on it, but these images just keep going. They keep filling our minds. And she posted images of Sherry Francis's work, who's a California painter. And she said, I think she has some kind of app that cuts and pastes her, you know, Brown's images. She said, she's pretty good at making my work.
What a compliment.
What a compliment. So with quite the following on the New York art scene, Brown's post echoed with well-known fashion editors, artists, and complete strangers who waged some less than friendly insults at Franson and suggested Brown should go after the artist for infringing on her work. The internet is a cruel and unforgiving place. And then I posted on Facebook some images of Willem de Kooning, who is the precursor to Cecily Brown.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, we talked about the technology, and it's a hotly debated issue in today's digital sphere where appropriation of images runs rampant. I mean, that's the truth. I mean, reposting and reblogging images is done without so much as thought to the legal implications of taking someone's work without their permission and sharing it across the internet. The same is true even with artists who build on images created by others in order to turn a profit. And this is where it gets ugly, the profit word. Think of Richard Prince's seeming disregard for the copyright law in his Canal Zone photographs, with his most recent exhibit at the Gagosian Gallery, where he appropriated Instagram images and priced them as for sale as $100,000 each. And none of the proceeds would have gone to the owner of the images. Well, I'd like to talk a little about my students here, Sheila. Yeah. You know, they have assignments that they have to do some of their own original work, and they go right to the internet and they find ways of somebody else, other student, put it on the internet, put it on, and they used it for that image. Now, I mean, that's leaves a professor in a precarious spot. Well, I've caught two students now that have done that, and I mean, I was actually kind to them because my boss said I should have given him a flat-out F. I actually have to talk about the copyright law now in front of the class every semester, because they go to the internet. There's nothing original about the work from some of these students, and that's a pathetic kind of sense of the use of the internet, and unfortunately, it's something we have to kind of reckon with in academia. Well, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Court issued last month an important decision for for artists. The Andy Warhol Foundation, which had filed a brief of amicus curiae in favor of Prince, stated that it does not object to other artists building freely on Mr. Warhol's work and the creation of new art, because its recognition of such freedom is essentially to fulfilling copyright goals of promoting creativity and expression. And we're going to show this right now in a music example.
That drum solo you just heard on Amen Brother is an instrumental on the B-side of the Winstons' 1969 single Color Him Father. It's reportedly been sampled over 1,000 times by artists as diverse as N.W.A., The Prodigy, David Bowie, Amy Winehouse, and Oasis. The writers never received any royalties due to the statute of limitations of just 3 years. The Winston singer, Richard L. Spencer, only discovered the prolific scale of the sampling because a UK record company called him up in 1996 trying to obtain the record's master tapes. Spencer shared his frustration in a radio interview. He said, "I felt invaded upon, like my privacy had been taken for granted." The young man who played the drum beat, Gregory Coleman, died homeless and broke in Atlanta, Georgia.
Wow.
So thanks to two British DJs who listened to that interview, Spencer finally got paid for the Amen break when the duo set up a fundraising page collecting donations of $30,000. It was nowhere near the tremendous debt the industry owes to the Winstons, but a kind gesture from real fans of the world in this most important drum loop.
Well, I think, yeah, one of the things, again, when we start getting into money and copyright, things explode.
I love thinking about this issue. There's an art side and a legal side, and they often don't match. Just like the Warhol discussion of that, as long as the art builds on the other art to make new art, that's an appropriate way of appropriation. And all through time, as we're talking about, artists have copied, borrowed, stolen images and ideas, and the questions that arise are interesting and provocative, adding to the question of what is art? No one has accused Verrocchio of stealing the David from Donatello.
Right. That's true.
And then the law is a blunt instrument, and when there's so much money being handed around, people can get really self-righteous. There's a clause in the U.S. Constitution that allows Congress to secure copyrights. It was strongly promoted by James Madison and strongly opposed by Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson said he wanted the ability of the public to share and build on the works of others, and Madison advocated for a 14-year period of exclusive rights in order to encourage writers by being rewarded for their creative work.
Wow, you know, that was pretty progressive there from Madison.
It certainly is.
Yeah, you know, he was way ahead of the curve. Well, art appropriation has been around us a long time, and it's in the art we see, the video games we play, the movies we see, and certainly the music we hear. So it will continue to be that way. The abuse of appropriations gets sticky and drawn out, and the dramas that grab the headlines, sometimes the artists win, sometimes the artists lose. And sometimes they win, as in the case of Led Zeppelin and the classic song Stairway to Heaven, which we'll close our show with. Anyway, artists and lawyers are not the best at friends at pajama parties, right? They're certainly not in art galleries and courtrooms. So most artists are not well-versed in legal matters. Most artists cannot even afford a good lawyer, and most artists probably don't know where to look. I have to tell you, Sheila, I'll end the show with, I tried a pro bono legal firm once, and that was a nightmare scenario. I mean, pro bono amounted to basically a pro headache. I mean, so copyright and appropriation can have a positive outcome of all genres. So we thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. And Sheila, what about our next show?
Well, we're going to have to decide that. Tom and I are going to be guests with our own Eric Bond on the Talk of Tacoma on Sunday, January 26th at 1 p.m. right here on WOWD Tacoma Park. And we look forward to sharing with Eric. So stay tuned then.
Okay, and stay tuned for Bobby Hill and this music. Bobby shares his incredible knowledge, his musical depth. Avant-garde jazz is right here. And next Sunday, Gail Behrens and Night Ride Home, another eclectic mix of songs. And experience art and the visual and everything we do. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
All it glitters is gold, and she's buying the stairway to heaven. When she gets there, she knows if the stores are all closed. With a word, she can get what she came for. She's buying a stairway to heaven. There's a sign on the wall, but she wants to be sure. 'Cause you know sometimes words have to mean. In a tree by the brook, there's a songbird who sings. Sometimes all of our thoughts.
New day will dawn for those who stand long